Hey friends, you're about to hear an interview with Preston Sprinkle, and other than being a really just engaging interview from Preston, what makes this unique is I did this interview over 2 years ago. So I need to start with an apology to Preston that it took so long. There were various factors. You know, most interviews that I do, they're over a specific book that is coming out at a certain time. We were just talking just to talk. So we talked about a lot of things. So it meant that there wasn't anything, time attached to it that I had to get that out to promote a certain book or anything. But there were other interviews that I did around the time that were time specific. And then COVID hit, and I kind of, if you paid attention, only released a couple of podcast episodes during that year. I kind of laid low. So all that to say, that is why this is so late. I am so sorry to Preston. Please accept my apologies for taking so long to release this. It wasn't a reflection of the importance of what we talked about or anything like that. It just kind of happened. I will say that since we've talked, Preston has released a book called Embodied: Transgender Identities, the Church, and What the Bible Has to Say. I haven't read it yet, but I know he's always very thoughtful in what he talks about. We talk a lot of great things in this podcast. We talk about hell, we talk about violence, we talk about knowledge and learning. So I hope that you like it as much as I did.
Hi, I'm Deb.
This is Frankie V.
I'm Grant.
Hi, this is Phil.
I'm Aaron.
I'm Steven.
Hi, I'm Jim.
Hi, I'm Matt.
We're Tim and Terry.
I'm Susan.
Hi, this is Phil.
Seminary Dropout is supported by listeners like you and me.
Seminary Dropout is supported by listeners like you and me.
You should support the show like I did.
It's easy.
It's easy.
Just visit supportseminarydropout.com.
Just go to supportseminarydropout.com.
And I'm your host, Shane Blackshear. Interviews with leading Christian authors, leaders, and thinkers. Let's go. My guest, Preston Sprinkle, is a professor, speaker, and a New York Times bestselling author. He earned a PhD in New Testament from Aberdeen University in Scotland, and he's been a professor of theology at Cedarville University in Ohio, Nottingham University in England, and Eternity Bible College. Preston is currently a full-time author, speaker, and teacher. He's written several books, one of which was Fight, A Christian Case for Nonviolence, which he came to Seminary Dropout to talk with me about a few years ago. He also hosts a daily radio show in Boise and a podcast. It's one of my favorites called Theology in the Raw. He responds to listener questions and also does interviews as well. Preston, thanks for being back, buddy.
Thanks for having me on, man. Yeah, excited to be back.
Dude, I mentioned your podcast. Here's the thing is, there's so many podcasts and so many good podcasts out there. And sometimes when I add a podcast to my podcatcher, it's aspirational. It's like, I think this will be good, but then the rubber hits the road when I go to actually listen to one. And I'm like, which one do I want to listen to? And I've found that often yours is one of my go-to, that this is what I actually want to listen to today. So, man, I really enjoyed it. You're doing a great job.
I can't believe people actually listen to my podcast. That's really encouraging. I mean, I just, like you know, you sit in a room and hit record, and all of a sudden people are like, hey, I heard your podcast. You're like, really? I didn't know people actually listened to this.
Totally. Well, and also, I think it's a mark of a good podcast when you have somebody on and I don't know them. I don't know anything about them. It's one thing, it's like when I publish an interview, if it's N.T. Wright, well, everybody wants to listen to that. But it might be someone that I just found value in, but they're not that well known. And, you know, I can see the download numbers. You're probably the same. And so, you know, I always strive to be a podcast that people want to listen to no matter what, that they trust that I'm going to have a good content, even if they don't know the person. But that's very rare. But I'm that way with Theology in the Raw. I'm like, I don't know who this person is, but I trust that there's going to be a really good conversation going on.
I'm like you, I think. I think we've had this conversation. I just really despise, and I don't think that's too strong, just the kind of underlying celebrity culture in Christianity.
Yeah.
And as you know, in modern day evangelicalism, you can get a huge platform, become famous without actually being very thoughtful or having anything that really intriguing to say. So I do have some people are big names that I have on, you know, but I will only have them on if I feel like they're also very thoughtful and are interesting. And I also have people I've had people that literally have no platform, never written a book, never anything. I just know them and I know they're a thoughtful person. I'm like, I want to elevate thoughtfulness over just some name, even if it means my number of listeners won't be as high because they're not going to be, you know, I'm not gonna have a clickbait, you know, conversational partner on my, you know, on my podcast feed. And I really don't care. I'd rather have a more interesting conversation than a celebrity, you know, preacher.
Right, right. Yeah, you had our friend Luke Thompson on not that long ago. Who's like you said, a super thoughtful guy, but he's never written anything. I don't think he has aspirations to. I don't think he's even on pastoral staff anywhere. It's just and it was a great conversation.
He's a stay-at-home dad that reads a lot of books and is incredibly brilliant. Right. I mean, really, I don't say that in at all. I mean, that's just what he is. But he's like head and shoulders above most people I know with a platform in terms of how deep and honest he's thinking through complex issues. So shout out to Luke. I'm sure you'll probably listen to this.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah. Well, I've been a stay-at-home dad too. And I'll tell you, it's not the path to stardom is what you're saying.
No, maybe not. Yeah, but it could be incredibly rewarding.
So last time we talked, well, not last time we talked, last time you were on Seminary Dropout, you were living in California. Are you from there originally? Did you grow up there?
I'm from there and I grew up there. And yeah, so the bio you read is about 5 years old. So lots happened since.
Okay.
Which is fine. I don't, you know, it's funny because you'd have different things floating around on the internet or whatever. And I'm like, some people, you know, professor at Nottingham University. I'm like, yeah, that was like 2007. So I grew up, born and raised in California, spent most of my, born in Southern California, grew up in Fresno, California, which is the armpit of California, as everybody from Fresno would very much agree with. And I spent a lot of years back in Southern California, lived in Scotland, lived in Ohio. And then for the last 5 years, I've been in Boise, Idaho, ever since 20. You know what? Almost to the day we moved up. 5 years ago on May 1st. So,
Where did you do your undergrad?
Undergrad at a place called the Masters College, now called the Masters University, otherwise known as John MacArthur's Christian College. I mean, he doesn't own it, but he's the president of it.
Sure. Okay. So, did you
qualify that, or now just let it sit?
What were you going to say?
I always feel like I need to say, yeah, I went to John MacArthur's, you know, college and seminary, but, you know, but whatever. Well, that's where I went, and I had a great time. It served my journey in helpful ways in some areas and challenged me in other areas, and it's all part of my journey.
Did you grow up in a faith that was John MacArthur-friendly-esque?
Yeah, so I was a nominal Christian in high school, meaning I would confess it but didn't live it. When I became serious with my faith at 19... It was in, I would say, and probably most of my audience knows this kind of church. I mean, non-denominational, kind of reformed-ish, kind of Baptistic, or much more Baptistic-ish without the Baptist label in the church name, you know, EV-free, Bible church, community church. And so, yeah, MacArthur was typically one of, you know, it was Charles Stanley, D. James Kennedy, John MacArthur, you know, those kind of leaders that would shape the kind of church environment I grew up in. I sipped on the punch, never really imbibed it. It was a context that was all I knew. And so I just said, but I was always kind of a free thinker, wouldn't be the right term, maybe an honest thinker. Like I would weigh, if they said, you know, this is what the Bible says, I'd be like, huh, interesting. So I'd go back and read the Bible. And sometimes I'd say, yeah, that makes sense. And other times like, I don't know, I'm not seeing that here, you know? So even though I was raised in that kind of culture, I was always, still, I think, honestly inquisitive is to the best of my ability.
Well, I mean, I think that's kind of one of your hallmarks when I think about you is kind of an intellectual honesty, specifically with the Bible. And I actually remember the first question I asked you when you came to talk about Fight was your book on nonviolence. Yeah, I read your bio, kind of, you know, you kind of from this Reformed tradition and around a lot of Reformed people. And I think my first question was, how much do your colleagues hate you? because I know. I mean, I grew up in that culture often, and I think you actually probably run with a pretty intellectually honest crowd, but often, boy, speaking against like things like the United States military might is not popular.
Yeah, I would say it was that book. And that book was kind of the culmination of podcasts and conversations. And so it was really, let's say that book was published in 2013, meaning I finished writing it in 2012, which means I was blogging from like, 2009, 2010, 2011 on that topic. So that kind of 5-year journey into nonviolence, that was kind of the thing that severed me from a certain brand of evangelicalism, sure. Which was actually a healthy thing. It's kind of like breaking up with a girlfriend that's not good for you. You know, it's like it hurts and it's painful and there's words said and there's misunderstanding. But at the end of the day, it's like for the overall health of my spiritual life, it was good that brand of evangelicalism. And you know what I mean. And most of my audience probably knows what I'm talking about. I don't particularly resonate with that brand. I don't want to run in those. I want to have dialogue with them, converse and praise them when they say something good and challenge them when they say something that I think is unbiblical. But at the end of the day, it was a good severance. You know, I just have no interest in anybody who's not willing to take presuppositions back to the biblical text and say, are these things so? I have no interest. That to me, that's not biblical Christianity. And so I want to swim in circles that are genuinely, honestly, and humbly biblically Christian. And there's a whole swath of evangelicalism, I'd say, that is biblical in word but not in practice, and I don't have an interest in. There's so many other people that are hungering to know what does the Bible actually say. I would rather devote my attention and time and allegiance to that kind of brand of evangelicalism.
Well, I think that that's why I kind of left that brand of evangelicalism, was because it felt like it simply didn't play by its own rules.
Yeah.
Because, you know, what they would say, the banner that they would hold was, we are, you know, biblical Christians, we follow the Bible. And the thing I realized was, except when they don't.
except when the Bible confronts their presuppositions that they're clinging to.
Yeah, that's right. Or, you know, American cultural values. So, do I remember, did you, maybe in your doctoral work, did you study Second Temple Judaism?
That was pretty much my main area. Technically, okay. My doctorate is in, well, I guess that on the piece of paper I got might have been religious studies, but it was New Testament. But my specific emphasis was more focused on Second Temple Judaism, otherwise known as just early Judaism,
right?
Or some people say, you know, intertestamental Judaism. But I would say two thirds of the time spent during my PhD was on directly interacting with Second Temple literature, which is why, that's why, one of the reasons why I wanted to do a PhD is I was kind of tired of reading books that were appealing to the Jewish background in the New Testament and saying, well, it means this, it means that. And, you know, there's debates about the New Testament that often comes back to the Jewish background. I'm like, I don't want to have to trust an expert in that material. I want to become an expert in that material so that I can know the literature firsthand. And it was one of the greatest joys of my academic journey was doing that, just spending thousands of hours in the Jewish background of the New Testament. It changed the way I read the New Testament forever.
Well, it feels like in scholarship recently, there's been and by recently, I mean like last, I don't know, 20 years, a real push to see things through that lens. It was as if like 20 years ago, somebody remembered, oh, I think Jesus was Jewish and maybe that mattered somehow. What do you think like the average person in the pew, like what are they missing about Judaism that matters, that might change the way that we look at what we read in the Bible?
God, I mean, there's so many things. Where do I start? Well, just the whole kind of revisiting of the Jewish background in the New Testament, it really started in the early 20th century, and it was a kind of a slow-moving kind of trajectory in scholarship, and it really started to blossom in like the 1970s. There was a scholar named E.P. Sanders who published a book on Judaism, and it was just a groundbreaking book. It was a thing that birthed, if you're familiar with, the New Perspective on Paul.
Yeah.
And that really was born out of this kind of going back to the actual Jewish material and seeing what does it actually say. And not kind of, well, I don't want to get too far down that rabbit hole. So yeah, some of the most fun, I think, oh man, where do I start? It's a modern tendency across the board. And this applies to those on the right, center, left, whatever. It's a modern tendency, or just a human tendency, to read an ancient text through your modern lens. Mm-hmm. And so even here, I mean, you know, right-leaning Christians in America are going to read Jesus as, you know, through an American kind of patriotic lens, and left-leaning people are going to read Jesus through some kind of like postmodern Western lens as well, you know? And so I think we have to be aware that no matter where we're coming from, we have a certain lens on that is going to fog up our interpretation of the first century Jewish Jesus. One of the big themes that we see once we appreciate the Jewish background is how religion and politics were so intertwined. To be a Jew in first century Palestine was wrapped up in politics. Now, I don't mean like partisanship. Like, when I say politics, I don't think Republican, Democrat. I'm thinking, you know, political concerns about Rome's rule over Palestine. Mm. That's just saturated. You can't even understand a theological message in the New Testament without understanding how intertwined it is with politics. So that, you know, when the early Christians were saying things like, you know, Jesus is Lord, this is Kurios, and you know that the backdrop of that is everybody saying, no, Caesar is Kurios, and he's the one that brings peace and salvation and prosperity to the world, and you know, human flourish. And, you know, so the Christian message is just so bound up with I would say political protest in some ways. And you can't, it's until you understand the background, you'll just kind of gloss over that. Like you won't really see how politically confrontive the Christian message is until you understand the background. But once you understand it, it's not like it's buried beneath the text, it's just kind of there, you know, kind of like in just to give you an example, like the whole book of Philippians is profoundly political. Well, you understand that like the city of Philippi was a kind of retirement retirement place for ex-military Roman citizens. And so the political fervor was just, you know, erupting in Philippi. And here you have these Christians who are saying the same language, like Jesus is Lord and our citizenship is in heaven, you know, and these aren't just abstract spiritual platitudes. I mean, they are, when Paul, especially in chapter 2 and 3, I mean, he is encouraging the Philippians to give their allegiance in such a way to Jesus that would be dangerous, physically, emotionally, financially, extremely dangerous, given the political climate of Philippi. And I don't, you know, after understanding that, it's like, this is what led me to say, is our Christian allegiance disruptive in American society? Are we giving our actual allegiance to Christ and not the state? You know, I mean, and there's so many other themes that spill out from that, but until patriotic people are nervous about our Christian proclamation, I don't know if we're actually embracing and promoting the Christian proclamation in a way that would resonate with the scandal of the New Testament.
Oh man, that's so good. I wouldn't say I've gone back and forth, but I mean, there was a point in time where I was just really, you know, extreme about kind of that empire criticism and Christians shouldn't even vote and yada yada. But for me, there's been extremes where you could say, you know, is the United States of America exactly what Rome was then?
I don't think it is.
But I also think it's a mistake to say that was then, this is now. We're in a Christian country now. It has nothing. It has nothing to do with that. They have nothing to teach us about how we relate to the state. And I like the way you put it. Like, just I think it's good just for Christians to be a little nervous and a little suspicious about our devotion to our country.
Yeah. You make a great point. We cannot, and I've made this mistake before, we cannot perfectly map America onto Rome in the first century. It just doesn't work. I mean, America has been profoundly shaped by a Judeo-Christian worldview, ethic. Again, I'm choosing my language really careful here. I said profoundly shaped. I'm not saying America embodies a Judeo-Christian ethic. I'm saying it exists in the wake of a massive Western movement that is intertwined with Judeo-Christianity, whereas Rome didn't know there wasn't an existence yet. Like it was a black and white contradistinction between Judeo-Christianity and Rome. It is fascinating, though, in the wake of, I mean, all the way back from Constantine in the fourth century onward, how much of Western culture has tried to integrate values that were very characteristic of Rome with values that were characteristic of Judeo-Christianity. So there is a profound syncretism there, so that America does reflect. I mean, there are some values in first century Rome that are really at home with 21st century, to it's with 20th century, especially America. But then there's also some important differences, even and there's political differences. We do live in a democracy, and first century was not a democracy. And so there are, yeah, I think we have to not just go to one extreme or the other, you know. There's a great book by Peter Lighthart called Between Babel and Beast. Mm. And it's his kind of articulation of the kind of, yeah, exactly what we're talking about. Like you know, Rome is not exactly America, but there are enough parallels that should allow us to go back to the biblical text and draw some, you know, pertinent analogies.
There's also, there's something dangerous about when, as a Christian, your country can make you comfortable. Like you mentioned, you know, Constantine, I think there's like a lot of ambiguity of what happened there with the church, when Christianity became like the preferred religion and one of privilege. And, you know, I think I kind of feel real weird about that because the message of Christianity kind of flourished, but I also feel like was compromised on a lot of fronts during that time. And so the other parallel I feel like is like we, in many ways still, although I feel like it's ending, in many ways, this is still, we're in Christendom in some ways. And there's a certain amount of privilege. You can't, at least thus far, you can't get elected president without at least claiming some kind of Christianity. And I think that there's something to be on guard against when your country offers you a measure of comfort as a Christian.
That's exactly right. The way I've often said it is, you know, Christianity was not designed to exist in a place of political power, but a place of political oppression or marginalization. It's not like you look at the New Testament, it's the very ethic of Christianity, first century Judeo-Christianity, is we are a marginalized people who are not wedded with the political powers to be, but we are being oppressed or at least marginalized by that. So when you flip that around and try to take a Christian worldview, a Christian ethic, and wed it to political power or even just positions of power, it's just not designed. It's oil and water. It's not designed to work that way. So that when you either explicitly or even subtly try to marry church and state, or even more, you know, less extreme, you know, try to win a culture war or something. I mean, Christianity is designed for that. You know, people say, well, can Christians serve in the government or positions of power? I'm like, well, I'm not saying they can't. I'm just saying that it just kind of goes against the grain of the rhythm of the New Testament. So yeah, I guess you can, but it's like, you're going to be buttoned up against all anti-rhythms, you know, rhythms that just go against Christianity. And yeah, I would say we are, and here's where I have to, I don't know, the extreme left and right, politically speaking, always makes me nervous. But whereas in the 80s and even 90s, what you said is certainly true, that Christians held positions of power and so on, politically speaking, I do think that is definitely shifting pretty rapidly, especially, I mean, when it comes to questions like sexuality and gender. I mean, to actually publicly, I mean, you have pretty much the monopoly in Hollywood and the music industry almost exclusively that would be they wouldn't say they're opposed to Christianity, but they would certainly be opposed to any sort of historical or global form of Christianity. So that with, you know, just little things like, you know, Chris Pratt attends a Christian church and everybody's in outrage.
Yeah, right, right. Yeah.
What the heck? How like, wait, are we not allowed to be like monotheistic in our, like, right. If somebody, a synagogue or a mosque, are you going to protest that too because they have a traditional sexual ethic believe that, you know, it's like, it's just the, or even like, I remember, you know, Bernie Sanders, who he's entertaining. You know, I like some of the stuff, I really like some of the stuff, drives me crazy, but he's entertaining nonetheless. But I remember once he was out, he just could not believe that Christians would think that other people of other religions would go to hell. Like, that sounds so harsh. And people were like, well, that's kind of just a fundamental part of Christianity. Do we want to kick all Christians out of America? Like, are you not allowed to be a Christian in this country? Is that
right?
How fascist, you know? Like, so I think that there is a public and growing and even pervasive outrage against anybody of influence. There's a growing outrage on in many circles, influential circles, against anybody that would, you know, embrace any kind of traditional Christian value. And I think that's, but so I will say that positively, I think that the separation between church and state, or genuine Christianity being no longer a position of power, but actually being a place of oppression. A lot of my conservative friends, you know, bemoan that. I'm like, actually, this is when faith thrives the most. When it's like there's pressure from above to actually be a Christian, I think that it can be a painful place. It can get you killed even, but I'm like, that's not necessarily a bad thing. This could be a really flourishing time for Christianity.
Totally. I was just about to say to, you know, all you were saying about the kind of negative Christian mindset in all these industries, you're exactly right. And there's a lot of, it's really hypocritical in there too, because a lot of these people will, you know, rightfully stand up for Muslim folks and other religions, but those are also very exclusive religions. My response is that the job of Christians then is not to get angry and outraged and try to gain power politically so that we can force people to feel a different way, because that always works, but to put our heads down and love our neighbors, to go next door and be friends with people and love them and lay our lives down for those around us.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. I mean, it's so tempting for anybody to respond in kind. And I would go so far to say some of the anti-Christian responses in the public sphere are really almost a backlash of being beat up by the moral majority.
Absolutely.
In the 80s. So it's like these extreme kind of, and I hate using left right categories, but you know, extreme left, extreme right, whatever, are just kind of mirroring each other. And it's like, well, we did the same thing back in the 80s, you know? So what's the way forward is respond with radical enemy love, humility, to embrace our marginalized and oppressed position and continue to love our oppressors, and don't do what the kind of back and forth has been doing for millennia. You know?
That's right. That's right. Yeah. I think the backlash against Christianity is a backlash against the privilege that Christians have held for so long and stewarded it so poorly and used it to do such damage in culture, I just affirm everything you said there. Our job is to get busy loving people and turning the other cheek and, you know, being like Jesus.
Yeah. You gotta break the cycle for sure.
That's right. That's right. So another thing that you, in the last several years, I spent a lot of time talking about, writing about, is hell and annihilationism and conditional mortality. I would bet that most people who are listening to this know what those things are, but real quick, can you give a quick definition?
Sure. Yeah, this has to do with the nature of hell. There's three dominant Christian views that have always been around. The most popular, at least in the West, for the last 1,500 years, is the traditional view, which is eternal conscious torment, that when somebody goes to hell, they will be existing in a conscious state of torment forever and ever and ever with no end. There's also universalism, which says there is a hell. One of the biggest misnomers is that universalists deny hell. They don't deny hell. They just believe that people can be rescued out of hell, either by a sovereign act of God overcoming unbelief in hell, or by their own willpower saying, you know, kind of crying uncle, okay, I've had enough. I embrace you, God, and God accepting a repentance. That would be the universalism view. And then there's the annihilation view, otherwise known as conditional immortality, which says there is a hell. It is irreversible, which would agree with eternal conscious torment, but that there is no ongoing torment or suffering, that when somebody goes to hell, they die, basically, that the wages of sin is death, and death would mean, you know, the cessation of life. And all those terms can be kind of like the term pacifism, whatever, like all these terms can be unhelpful because people assume too much based on the term itself. So
yeah,
helpful to try to understand the position, not just assume you know what it's trying to say by based on the term, that the label that's slapped onto it.
And so you've come around in the last several years to conditional mortality. I have as well. It's it's interesting. I had Graham Ware and Chris Date on the show a couple of years ago representing Rethinking Hell. That was one of the most listened to downloaded episodes that year. And I had some big names that year. And I was really surprised, but it seems like that it's something that people are really hungry for is rethinking that. And it's just an interest to people.
Yeah, that's fascinating, man. I think more people are interested in this conversation than people realize. I'm just going to say what I think and let the cards fall where they may.
All right.
Having worked through these three positions, universalism, eternal conscious torment, and annihilation, again, with as fair of an approach as I can, trying to say, look, whatever the text says, let's just go where the text leads. If it leads to universalism, let's embrace that. If it's ECT, let's embrace that. If annihilation, so on. And I tried to, honestly, I don't know what this makes me on an Enneagram, but I'm highly intellectual, low, like empathy, I think is what it would be. Mm. I had to work at empathy. I think empathy is incredibly important. It just doesn't come as naturally to me. So I've often said from the beginning, I'll say it now, like if God wants to torment people forever and ever, he's creator, I'm not, so be it. Like we don't have the right as creator to say, I can never serve a God. That's just not how you approached the divine. If you believe that the divine is actually divine and is creator. So I've never had a emotional, certainly it's absolutely horrendous to think God would do that, but he gets to tell us who he is. I don't get to tell God who he must be. Like that's all, having said all that, based on just several years of studying the text, the annihilation view of hell is among the most clearest, most comprehensive taught doctrines in all of scripture that I've ever encountered in the 25 years of my professional kind of, you know, Christian journey. Yeah. And I see so minimal and dismal evidence for the eternal conscious torment view. And look, one of the beauties of postmodernism is this is my journey. So nobody out there can say, no, you're wrong. It's my journey. I'm just telling you my journey. And I just, having worked through all the, what about this? What about that? In this passage and that passage, it's bizarre psychologically how more and more people haven't embraced annihilation if they've actually come out the text fairly. It's overwhelming, the support, the biblical support for annihilation. I would even see more support for universalism than eternal conscious torment, quite honestly. But annihilation by definition rules out universalism. ECT, eternal conscious torment, actually leaves the door open. I mean, if you believe that God will miraculously preserve somebody to stay alive through the worst pain possible for billions and billions of years, and they're conscious, I'm going to go on a limb and say, I think after a while that person's going to repent. And I think they're just going to be like, you know, I've had enough. So you have to believe that God is going to either not accept their repentance or prevent them from repenting for all eternity. I don't know how to square that with scripture. So I think the ECT view actually has more of a burden to say that universalism is not true. Annihilation rules it out. I mean, when you go to hell, you die, there's no more you, like you're gone. And so there is no chance at universalism. So actually I take the annihilation view in some sense, the more conservative view for those who are scared, oh, this is just going to lead to universalism and, you know, everybody's going to stop believing in Jesus and whatever. I say, no, actually, I think the eternal conscious torment view might lead to that. I don't think the annihilation would lead there at all.
Mm. I think for myself, in the beginning, when I first started considering this, and honestly, before that, I hadn't really thought, and I think this is probably the case for most ECT people, I hadn't thought about the realities of it for a long time. Honestly, because I think it's soul-crushing and doubt-inducing and a lot of other stuff. Where I started, you know, I was hearing Greg Boyd talk about this, and I had John Stott on the podcast, and he talked about it a little bit. I hesitate to like say this out loud, but it's just the truth, so I'll say it. It just, before I really dug into the scriptures about it, there just started to become this kind of feeling of like, man, I don't know if that's consistent with like who God is revealed to be in the Bible and through Jesus. Now, I the reason I hesitate to say that is because there's just a lot of people who they want to like all the theology that they have, and they want to make God in their image to fit that. And so I always want to stay away from that. And always, like, I think it's good if I'm kind of uncomfortable with some stuff every once in a while, because I think it keeps me honest, you know? But it just seemed like the God who was revealed in the Bible just didn't really seem to jive with the narrative of eternal conscious torment. And then when, you know, I started listening to the Rethinking Hell guys and some of the stuff you were saying, then realized, oh, right. It is, like you were saying, it is very compelling, the narrative. And I also saw, it's kind of like what you're talking about with the ancient Judaism stuff, like, once you see it, it's everywhere. And so, and I think that's why the churches you preach, ECT, they have to rewrite your vocabulary. So they have to say, death doesn't really mean death. It means going to hell. That's a spiritual death. And so that then every time you read, you know, John 3:16, you read about the death part, you're reading going to hell for eternal. You're reading not death, because they've rewired your vocabulary to read that in there.
That's exactly right. I want to go back really quick to your, the role of emotion in this conversation.
Yeah.
Let me clarify too. Again, when I say I came at this question and didn't kind of front load any kind of emotional aversion to ECT, I'm not saying that's just me, the way I'm wired in my journey.
Sure, I do sure.
That emotions can go either way. I think discomfort with a certain doctrine, teaching, statement could spring from a fleshly desire to make God in our own image, or it could spring from a holy desire.
That's right.
Where our understanding of the God who is revealed in Jesus just doesn't resonate with this kind of, you know, other doctrine over here. And so, you know, and that's kind of it's kind of a subjective, mysterious, difficult to unravel which one is it fleshly or is it holy? From my vantage point, the pushback against annihilation is almost always, it's not a biblical doctrine. So I really wanted to work hard and not to let emotions play a role in that. Largely for apologetic reasons, so that nobody could ever say, oh, you just want to believe in annihilation, or you just believe in annihilation because you want to, not because of the Bible. I'm like, no, I'm not even an emotional person in that sense. So I just want to make sure that we are prioritizing the Bible here, which can play a holy role in that. Oh, you said something else I forgot after that I wanted to respond to.
If you think of it, jump in. Yeah. Well, it's funny you mentioned, you know, people jumping to it's not a biblical doctrine, because I've found when I'm listening to scholars who are on the ECT side, they're almost always like their strongest argument has to be Christian history. Because the church did affirm for a very, very long time eternal conscious torment, right?
Yeah, exactly. And it was so funny. I mean, I think you were there. We were at a conference last year, right? Well, let me just be really general, because I don't want to throw anybody under the bus, but I did hear a Baptist theologian.
Yes.
who endorses ECT use almost an exclusively historical argument, saying, look, this is the way we've understood these texts. And so, and that was kind of his main argument, not just an argument, but the weight of history is on our side. And then somebody kind of pushed him on, wait a minute, where's the church been on, you know, a believer's baptism or adult baptism? He's like, oh no, everybody was infant Baptist. And they're like, kind of, and the whole room kind of sat there and like, well, why are you a Baptist? He's like, well, because I think the New Testament teaches it. And I think I just said, amen. Like, I'm 100% in agreement with your methodology. So yeah, I think the weight of history, and also, oh, what I wanted to say earlier was, you are absolutely correct that two things. By far, most people who believe in ECT believe it not because they genuinely laid out both options as legitimate possibilities, ECT and annihilation, and based on, you know, a fair exegesis of the passages, just said, oh, the weight of evidence obviously is on ECT. Almost everybody just assumes that this is part of Orthodox Christianity, so any other option of hell is not an option.
Yeah, yeah.
Or if you do examine annihilation, you're coming at it in a defensive posture, saying, I need to show why this is wrong because we already know that it's heresy. So, because it's in our doctrinal statements. It's in our doctrinal statement. I can't even pastor this church anymore if I don't believe in it. And lots of wise people formed this doctrinal statement before me, so it must be heresy. So, no, I mean, few people, I would say a growing number are, but I mean, a few people in the past have really genuinely approached, you know, ECT versus annihilation from a fair vantage point. Also, yes, our very categories of this whole discussion on hell and the afterlife and what does death mean have been so saturated by, you know, the assumption that the ECT view is correct. Like, the ECT view has provided us with the very language categories that most people operate within.
You know, at that Rethinking Hell conference you were talking about last year, there was a lot of talk of like, are the tides turning? You know, are more people coming to this conditional mortality perspective? And I think more are, but I'm doubtful that there's going to be a huge tide shift. And part of that is because as human beings, we are attracted to extremes. And so it being seen as the extremes are ECT and universalism. And so I know so many people who went from ECT straight to universalism and really didn't even stop at conditional mortality. I know those aren't exactly like linear, you know, one's in the middle and one's on the side, but they just straight up go to straight to universalism without even considering any other possibility.
You've seen that? That's interesting.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah, for sure. For sure. And well, and I know, like, even for myself, there were years I didn't even know there was another option. I thought it was ECT and universalism. So something you bring up often on your podcast, Jonathan Haidt, The Righteous Mind.
Ah, yes. My second Bible.
It's funny. One of my good friends who actually lives with us here, he was, he was going to school and was bringing up The Righteous Mind a lot. And then I heard you talk about it. And so I listened to the audio book about it. So real quick, give the briefest, it's a very large book. I mean, and just complicated, but give a brief rundown of like, what's The Righteous Mind about?
Yeah. Well, you know, it is a very thoughtful quasi, I mean, he's a brilliant scholar, but it's a very readable book. I found, like, he's a very clear writer.
Yeah.
And he kind of, everything he says at the end of the chapter, he summarizes it, point one, point two. So it's a real, it's one of those books you read and you kind of walk away with a good handle on what he's saying. Basically, the subtitle, The Righteous Mind subtitle, is Why Good People Disagree on Politics and Religion. So anybody out there listening, which is probably 90% of you, who found yourself in the most frustrating conversation with somebody about some religious topic, some political topic, and they are just unwilling to budge no matter what kind of evidence you provide. They're so committed to their position, no matter the evidence, you know, like, no, 2 + 2 = 5. You're like, no, like, look, I think it equals 4 and I'm showing you tons of evidence. And they're like, no, you know, and this book will help you understand the psychology of what's going on in somebody when you're in those kind of conversations. That's kind of the practical payoff. But basically he shows, I would say proves, that 90% of what we believe is because we want to believe it. It's out of intuition. It's out of a desire to believe it. And only like 10% of our belief system is kind of rationalized after the fact. And Jonathan Haidt has a famous analogy of a little rider on top of a huge elephant. The rider on top of the elephant is our rational reasoning, our kind of cool reasoning, you know? And the elephant represents our intuition, our emotions, our desires. And the elephant's going to go where he wants to go. The rider can kind of tug his ear and pull him and maybe stir him a little bit. But at the end of the day, we are going to believe what we're going to believe out of a desire to believe it. So this is incredibly helpful when we're in conversations, dialogues, or debates, when we're trying to persuade people to believe away from erroneous belief and towards truth. We often just target the rider, rational reasoning, you know, argument after argument. And he's like, that's just not, it's rarely is that effective. You need to speak to the elephant, which means you need to go show honor to the person. You need to show points of agreement. You know, if you think Donald Trump is Satan incarnate and your uncle thinks Donald Trump is the Messiah, if you just yell and scream and get angry and demean that person and call him a racist and a Nazi and, you know, baby killer, or, you know, killing people at the border, or whatever, that's not going to go anywhere. You need to, as hard as it may be, you know, find points of resonance. So, you know what, Uncle Bob, like, you obviously have thought through this a lot, and I totally see where you're coming from. I mean, Donald Trump, you know, I could see where, you know, he's done a lot of good things. And this may make you cringe even doing this, but, you know, but seriously, but if you don't show honor to the person, their walls are just going to be up. If they feel like they've been, the number one thing is, does the other person feel like you actually are trying to understand where they're coming from? What if they simply sense that the walls are starting to drop on them being able to even listen to what you're saying? If you don't show them honor, if you don't genuinely try to listen to them, affirm, you know, not everything the person is saying is evil, and not everything Donald Trump does is evil. Like, you can think he's the worst president ever, but even the worst human, you know, even Hitler ate vegetables and was a vegetarian. I mean, eating vegetables, you know, it's like, and you have to find those points of agreement. Anyway, I can go on and on and on, but I have like, I mean, in the margins of my book, this should be required reading for anybody going to the ministry, because so much of what you do as a pastor, as a leader, or just as a Christian thinker is living with and interacting with people that need to be persuaded towards the truth. And we can't just do that through rational reasoning or getting angry or demeaning the other person.
I will say it's almost depressing to a point. I mean, there's almost like a fatalistic edge to it of like, you think you, because that's the thing is he's, you know, he knows the type of person who's going to read that book. And it's like, we all know, like we all picture certain people or types of people when he's talking about that. But he also doesn't let the reader off the hook. It's like, you think you believe the stuff you believe for good reason, but you really don't. You're really also the little rider on the elephant.
What's fascinating is his own story. I mean, he's an atheist Jew from New York. I mean, grew up with nothing but far, far left environment. And he got interested in this topic because he was so frustrated that conservatives seem to keep winning. And so he did a huge study on how can this be? And then he realized that, like, it's because, and one of his big things in the book is, you know, humans from an evolutionary standpoint have like, what did he say? Six moral. One is like harm and care. You know, one is like submission and authority, or, you know, these kind of paradigms. And he says liberals only touch on one of those, right, maybe two. Right. That's harm. Everything's about harm. Well, you're harming the community, harming this, or harming us, or harming, you know, conservative ideas are harming everybody. And if you just, you know, did some analytics on how many people are crying harm on everything, you know, but that's, if you reduce ethics to just the harm principle, you're touching on one of six moral impulses that people have. But conservatives typically touch on like all five or six. They may not, you know, triumph the harm one, but they will talk about authority and purity and, you know, they'll touch on all these other moral principles. It was when he traveled to India and did some research there and realized that, like, oh, like purity and impurity are huge moral categories there, because that actually resonates with most people. people. Like, that's not abnormal, you know, and authority and submission and honor shame type stuff. And so he's actually more of a centrist now politically, but his whole motivation was to try to help the left win because they were
didn't understand
the kind of conservative mindset. And he had to kind of understand that to realize how we can better push more of a left agenda. At least that was his motivation at the beginning.
Now, have you read his last book, The Coddling of the American Mind?
So good. I haven't
read it yet, but I heard his interview on Sam Harris's podcast where I feel like, you know, okay, I get the gist of it. Like he impacted enough. And so my understanding is it kind of deals with all this, the controversy over like trigger warnings in universities, and basically the idea of staying away from running from things that feel threatening, rather than confronting and dealing with them. And so I think people, unless you've had your head in the sand for the last 5 years or so, people kind of understand what that's about.
Yeah. I would say it's, to my mind, the most important book of 2018.
Wow.
Just because it's for on so many levels. I mean, for the big focus of that book is why have we seen such a massive shift on university campuses since 2014? Like you can almost to the month.
Yeah.
This massive rise in anxiety, depression, suicide ideation, people, frantic about being, you know, killed and raped and all these things, even though like in almost every metric, we live in the most safest, secure society that the history of humanity has ever seen. Why is there such an exponential increase in fear and over concern for safetyism? Not against, and they make a big distinction between, there's a difference between somebody being physically or emotionally or verbally bullied. That's bad.
Right. Yeah.
Versus somebody presenting persuasively an idea you don't agree with.
Right.
Like you know, what if, you know, he says there's a difference between, you know, making fun of somebody, demeaning them, versus having somebody on your college campus that's giving an hour-long persuasive speech on why Trump is the best president ever.
Yeah.
If that kind of speech triggers you and sends you into sort of traumatic spaces, then there's some deeper fundamental issues going on. You should be able to live in a society where you can hear not demeaning rhetoric, but somebody presenting a case for something that you aggressively oppose. How do you address that? You provide better evidence. You have the dialogue. But he says college campuses, a lot of them are just, I mean, unable to do that. And he says that is setting ourselves up for a generation of absolute failure. And their whole point is, how good intentions are actually harming people. Like the sort of coddling of the student's mind is actually going to drastically cause way more harm in the future, which is why we see a huge rise in anxiety, depression, and loneliness and suicide ideation because of the coddling that's happened. And they, they compare it to things like our immune system. Like if you coddle your immune system and don't expose it to certain stressors your immune system gets incredibly weak. Your body, if you coddle your body and don't expose it to stressors, it's actually really unhealthy. And this comes from another public scholar, Nassim Taleb, who wrote a book called Anti-Fragility. Brilliant book. That's a really hard book to read, but the whole principle is that we are designed to get stronger and better, not when we're bullied, okay, but when we face
adversity,
an idea, even just physical opposition in terms of like lifting weights, you know, and we're actually doing long-term damage when we overly coddle people, and safe spaces can be some of those dangerous, harmful things we can do to people in college, quite honestly.
I remember also he talks about like the part of this one is, has come about. And like you said, you can almost pinpoint the date is because we started raising children in a certain way at a certain time, and how he thinks it's really important for kids to have space where there's not an adult immediately there, so that when there's conflict that arises, that they among themselves have to work that out. And that makes so much sense to me, that we as parents, we just want to immediately like rescue our kids from any kind of adversity or you know, problems that might arise, and they never learn from themselves how to work anything out.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's been one of the most. Yeah, that book has been hugely influential in my parenting. It makes total sense, but I found myself erring on the side of being overly safe, or I see kids mm-hmm. and, or even like, you know, if our kids are like, you know, somebody teases them at school, or even a teacher, you know, is kind of unjust or does something, like, these are actually good. Like, we don't want to coddle them from all kinds of like challenges in life. Now, again, bullying is bad, or even, you know, they trace the whole culture of safetyism back to the 1980s. And he says, look, it's good that we have bike helmets now. Mm-hmm. It's good that we have seatbelt laws. Like, there are certain aspects of safety, you know, safetyism, as they call it, that are good, that are helping against physical harm. But, you know, not letting your kids walk to the, you know, store by themselves for fear of getting kidnapped. He's like, look, by not letting our kids venture out in life and learning life on their own, that is actually going to produce much more long-term harm. We live in, again, statistically the safest society that the world has ever seen. Like, and, you know, 30 years ago, like when you and I grew up, Shane, I mean, we were doing all kinds of stuff by ourselves, you know, you know, good to fall off your bike and scrape your knee. It's good to, you know that there's a, you know, a difficult neighbor around the corner. It's good to teach your kids to learn how to cross the road without, you know, the parent holding their hand when they're 15 years old, you know,
right,
I mean,
right.
We need to take more risks. In the long run, it's going to be better for the anti-fragility, or the way our kids are going to operate successfully in society down the road.
So I would say, and as I was listening to that interview with Jonathan Haidt on Sam Harris's podcast about the book, I would, because so much of this centers around the specific story, especially when you talk about trigger warnings and also, you know, administrators on campus being fired for saying the wrong things. A lot of that centers around issues around race. And I would like to hear from my friends of color who read the book or are familiar with the concepts and hear from them what they think about it, because there is so much stuff that my white guy mind doesn't catch or that makes sense to me that is frankly wrong. And so I would like to hear from my friends of color on that and see, you know, where is there anything where, you know, that maybe Jonathan Haidt would say that they'd say, nah, I think he got that wrong, or and what's right and all of that.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. Yeah. And they do talk a decent amount about race in particular in there. And they do have, I know they do have at least a lot of stories in there, but again, yeah, they are two, you know, white male authors that isn't a neutral thing that they're bringing to the table. So yeah, I think that's a great question. Yeah.
Well, Preston, man, it's been so good. I think I could talk to you for another hour or so, but thanks for taking the time to be on Seminary Dropout.
Yeah, dude. Thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
Thanks for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Remember, you can find all the show notes for this show and all shows at shaneblackshear.com. Oh, and hey, have you ever thought about starting your very own podcast? I bet you have, and I think you should do it. In fact, I've created a course just for you to teach you everything that I've learned over the last couple of years producing Seminary Dropout. So if you're interested in podcasting and want to learn how, go check out my course. You can go there by typing in podcastingforeveryone.org. And you can get a special discount by typing in the discount code Seminary Dropout, all one word. That'll give you 25% off. So go check it out. If you have any questions, let me know. Okay. Thanks to those that left ratings and reviews on iTunes this week. Remember, that keeps the show front and center. Also, remember, you can find me on Twitter at @beardonabike. That's @beardonabike. Also, I'm on Facebook, facebook.com/ShaneBlackshear123. And remember that Seminary Dropout is listener supported. You can visit supportseminarydropout.com and press Become a Patron. Remember, this music you're listening to right now is by D.L. Rossi. You can find him online on iTunes and at dlrossi.com. All right, thanks again for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Stay tuned for next week's episode. Love you. Take care. Yeah,